action, even when living in the midst of others who were uneducated. Family ties. We have already noticed some of the social patterns of middleman minorities, the children working in the family business, for example. These businesses tended to remain family businesses, even when the peddler became the store owner and the store owner expanded into ownership of a chain of stores or the proprietor of a factory. This has been true of Jewish businesses, overseas Chinese businesses, Lebanese businesses, and businesses run by Gujaratis and Chechars from India. Even when these enterprises became businesses of international scope, family ties spread across national boundaries. Among the reasons for the success of Jews and Lebanese in particular in the import-export business have been their family ties on both ends of many shipments and many international financial transactions. It was much the same story with the Armenians in earlier centuries. Similarly, today, with the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia, whose family financial links often reach from country to country in that region, with capital being shifted from place to place according to both economic and political developments in particular countries. Intense family loyalties have led middleman minorities to take young relatives into their businesses, even when these might have to be brought from overseas in India or Lebanon or elsewhere. Among the Lebanese living in other countries, for example, a successful emigrant would send back for others from his family and village, leading to clusters of emigrants from the same district in some town or region of the country of settlement. In Argentina or Sierra Leone, for example, established Lebanese would lend money to new arrivals or create business partnerships with them. This has been just one aspect of strongly felt mutual obligations within families. Some middleman minorities have been noted for their remittances to family members in the countries from which they came, or in other countries in which they have settled. Local populations have long resented this as exporting their country's wealth, a charge often made against the Chinese in Southeast Asia and the Lebanese in many countries. Even in the early years of Jewish poverty in the United States, those in America managed to send money back to family members in Eastern Europe, not only for subsistence, but also to pay for their passage to the United States. These international transfers of wealth, though large in the aggregate, were no net reduction of the wealth of the country from which they were sent, because the middleman minorities had already added to the pre-existing wealth of the countries in which they settled, and were sending abroad only a fraction of that net addition. The central role of families, their cohesiveness, cooperation, and loyalties, has long been a common denominator among middleman minorities around the world. Their successes have not been simply the individual successes of cream rising to the top in isolation, though such groups have in fact turned out many remarkable individuals in many fields. Other groups, without the same strong and stable family backgrounds found among middleman minorities, have succeeded disproportionately in those few areas where purely individual talents are the overriding factors, such as sports and entertainment. In the United States, the Irish in the 19th century and blacks in the 20th century became spectacularly successful in boxing and baseball, as well as among singers and other entertainers, despite their lagging behind other groups in business, science, and other fields with more prerequisites of cultural or social capital. Both the 19th century Irish and the 20th century blacks were noted for high rates of broken families, violence, alcoholism, and crime. It is hardly surprising that both groups succeeded, not only as well as others, but far more so than most others, in fields where only the individual's abilities mattered. Such fields attracted a disproportionate share of their most able and ambitious young people, who often lacked the social prerequisites for widespread success in other fields. While intergroup comparisons have been discouraged by the taboo against blaming the victim, blame is in fact irrelevant. Certainly no individual or group has any control over the past from which their social and cultural legacy has come. What intergroup comparisons can tell us is which things have turned out to produce what results under what circumstances. If nothing else, that can warn us against blind alleys and counterproductive efforts, and against demagogues who would lead the young especially into those blind alleys and into self-destructive attitudes and behavior. Patterns within groups. Commercial, as well as family ties, have been strong within various middleman minorities. German Jewish businesses were among the main employers of Eastern European Jewish immigrants who arrived in the United States during the late 19th century. Even earlier, Jewish peddlers were able to get goods to sell on credit from more substantial Jewish businesses, not only in the United States, but also in Latin America. Young men from commercial families in India and Lebanon were sent out to East and West Africa, respectively, to establish small businesses, often back in the interior hinterlands, where European businesses seldom ventured. The international textile networks established by the Lebanese in Manchester supplied goods sold by Lebanese merchants and peddlers overseas. Cotton, bought by Indian middlemen from East African farmers, was shipped back to Bombay to be woven into cloth to be sold in international markets. One of the many practical benefits of close ties within a middleman minority has been an ability to conduct business with one another at lower costs because of less need to resort to precautions before making transactions or to the formal legal system afterward, both of which can be costly and time-consuming. Thus, Lebanese diamond dealers in Sierra Leone have handed over diamonds to one another without even getting receipts, as Hasidic Jews have done in New York's diamond district. Such mutual trust has also been common in commercial transactions in general among the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia. It was likewise the basis of international trade among the Armenians in earlier centuries. These widely spread but highly interrelated individual enterprises operated under the ethos of trust. Trust and the shared moral and ethical norms underlying it helped the Armenian trading houses to avoid the relatively rigid and costly operation of the hierarchic system of organization practiced by the English. Seen in this light, trust served as a human capital, but one that could not be acquired through a rational investment decision. It accrued to the Armenian merchant community as a result of their collective socio-political experiences over many generations. Based on family kinship and trusted fellow countrymen, the Armenian trading house did, indeed, rely on trust as its principal means of organization and control. These middlemen minorities have thus been able to take advantage of business opportunities that others would either be reluctant to risk or could do so only with precautions that cost time and money. But such a mode of operation becomes practical only on the basis of strong social ties and enduring economic relationships that make cheating too costly to attempt. Despite the frugal living common to middleman minorities around the world, they have also been notable for their donations to their own charitable institutions, such as hospitals and schools, and often to charitable institutions serving the larger society around them. At a minimum, they have avoided the social stigma of having the poorer individuals and families in their respective groups become public charges on the larger society. The close ties within middleman minorities have led some to imagine a wider web of loyalties than has actually existed. Such phrases as "Jews all stick together" confuse intense loyalties within particular subsets of Jews or other middleman minorities with a solidarity encompassing the whole population of the group. However, when Eastern European Jews began arriving in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the predominantly German Jewish community viewed their arrival with alarm. The Jewish press, which was largely controlled by German Jews at that time, characterized the new immigrants as slovenly in dress, loud in manners, and vulgar in discourse, people speaking a piggish jargon, that is, Yiddish. The highly acculturated German Jews feared that the huge influx of Eastern European Jews with foreign ways would cause the larger society to raise barriers against all Jews, a fear that turned out to be well-founded. Programs set up by German Jews to try to acculturate Eastern European Jews in order to minimize the larger society's adverse reaction to Jews in general included pointed lessons on the use of soap and water. When Eastern European Jews moved into German Jewish neighborhoods in Chicago, the German Jews moved out. Both in Chicago and New York at that time, most Eastern European Jews could not afford to live where German Jews lived in the first place. German Jews were willing to employ Eastern European Jews, but living near them was something else. Moreover, even within the poorer Eastern European Jewish neighborhoods on the Lower East Side of New York, Hungarian Jews had their own enclaves, separate from the enclaves of Russian or Polish Jews. There was a low intermarriage rate among these various subgroups of Eastern European Jews and a mutual incomprehension and intolerance that kept Jews apart. Mutual aid societies among the Jews were likewise broken down by nationality groups, among other breakdowns. Even in the small Jewish communities back in colonial America, Sephardic Jews were known to disown children who married Ashkenazic Jews. Similar sectarian, national, and ideological divisions split Jewish communities throughout the Western Hemisphere and in Europe. In 18th century France, Sephardic Jews expressed the same views as some Gentiles that Ashkenazic Jews were not yet ready for equal citizenship. In some places, neither marriage nor burial crossed these lines of internal division. Footnote. When I was in Australia during my research on ethnic groups around the world, members of Jewish groups in Sydney and Melbourne both went to great lengths to tell me of the differences between the Jews who had settled in these cities. Both also repeated the same saying, Melbourne is a cold city with warm Jews, and Sydney is a warm city with cold Jews. End footnote. Similarly, among the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia and the Western Hemisphere, where people from different parts of China belong to different formal and informal networks and live separate social lives, often speaking mutually unintelligible dialects and specializing in different sectors of the economy. As a scholarly study noted, were the comprador of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank in Singapore to be a Cantonese, it was less likely that a merchant who was Chao Zhou could gain access to the Hong Kong Bank. Chinese banks themselves were dominated by these dialect and kin divisions. For example, the Chinese Commercial Bank, established 1912, the Ho Hong Bank, 1917, and the Overseas Chinese Bank, 1919, were all Hokkien banks. Li Hua Bank, 1920, was a Cantonese bank. The Overseas Union was a Chao Zhou bank. Here, not only the directors and officers, but also the customers and depositors were drawn from a similar dialect background. Among the Lebanese, there was certainly no solidarity between Christian and Muslim Lebanese. Moreover, among the Muslims, there were divisions between the Sunni and the Shiites. And among the Christians, there were divisions among the Catholics, Maronites, and Orthodox. These, of course, all had separate religious institutions, but they also had separate social and business networks. Among the Lebanese who settled in Australia, their regional loyalty seldom extended beyond that of the village in Lebanon from which they had come. A history of bitter and lethal intergroup violence in Lebanon and Syria, taking thousands of lives at a time, was part of the legacy that Lebanese took to other countries in which they settled. Even in a small country like Sierra Leone, the many internal disputes among various Lebanese factions, which spilled over into the courts and involved political authorities, proved too baffling for either Europeans or Africans to understand, much less settle, during the colonial era. Indeed, one of the main tasks of diplomatic representatives from Lebanon and Sierra Leone after independence was to arbitrate these internal disputes among various Lebanese factions there. Conflicts among various Lebanese Shiite groups spread as far as Australia, and conflict among Lebanese political groups led to the assassination of a refugee from Lebanon living in Brazil. The various Indian middleman minorities, such as the Gujaratis and the Chechars, have had separate social and economic institutions, both in India and in the many countries where they have settled overseas. As a study of Indian emigration pointed out, most Indians emigrate primarily as members of their subgroup, as Gujaratis, Jains, Sikhs, or Muslims, and most still have arranged marriages within their subgroup. Another study, of Indians in East Africa, notes that they have been fragmented into so many linguistic, religious, caste, and other subgroups as to constitute a community almost exclusively in the minds of outsiders. The Armenian community in the Ottoman Empire was likewise beset by factionalism. The difference is not between atomistic independence and group-wide ties. Subgroup ties and loyalties within middleman minorities have often been intense, but have seldom encompassed all the people lumped together by others. Education. As communities determine to maintain their own values and work ethic without allowing their children to be influenced by the very different values they often found in the societies around them, middleman minorities have often had their own social institutions, including their own private schools, after they reached an economic level where they could afford them. Even when their children went to public schools, as among Jews in the United States, there were often supplementary schools, such as the Hebrew schools. In other countries, there were often full-time private schools for the children of middlemen minorities, teaching in the Chinese language, the Gujarati language, or whatever the particular language of the particular middleman minority might be. Education has for centuries been a high priority among Jews, even in times and places where illiteracy was the norm among the people around them. A Russian official reported on the Jews in Russian-conquered Poland in 1818. Almost every one of their families hires a tutor to teach its children, and their entire population studies. He added, "Girls too can read, even the girls of the poorest families. Every family, be it in the most modest circumstances, buys books because there will be at least 10 books in every household. Most of those inhabiting the huts in Gentile villages have only recently heard of an alphabet book." Nearly two centuries later, when television host Brian Lamb asked author Abigail Thernstrom why Jews scored so well on the Scholastic Aptitude Test, she replied, "They have been preparing for it for 1,000 years. This is not to say that education was necessarily the factor that first lifted middleman minorities out of poverty. Among the immigrant Jews in America, for example, most worked in manual occupations during the last decades of the 19th century, and no Jewish child in New York City graduated from a public high school then because the first graduating class from any public high school in New York was the class of 1902. A survey of city college students in 1951, when most of these students were Jewish, showed that only 17% of their fathers who were born before 1911 had completed the 8th grade. But Jews were already beginning to rise economically. Their economic improvement meant that their children's labor was no longer necessary to enable the family to survive, so that these children could now go on to finish high school or college. Higher education was the effect, rather than the cause, of their initial rise, and it would also become the vehicle by which later generations of Jews could move on into the professions. Even before that was possible, however, the intellectual interest was manifest. A survey of public libraries in New York's Lower East Side tenement neighborhoods, where Russian Jews lived in 1912, showed that over half the books borrowed were nonfiction, and that most of the fiction was by such authors as Tolstoy, Dumas, and Dickens, while lightweight bestsellers gathered dust on the shelves. New York's free public libraries, free public lectures, and above all, free city colleges were a godsend to the Jews. When the College of the City of New York, once known as the Working Man's Harvard, was a distinguished institution that admitted students strictly on their academic records, 3/4 of its students were Jewish. Some other colleges, notably Harvard, set upper limits on the number of Jewish students they would admit because of a fear that otherwise Jews would overrun the institution, because so many were so highly qualified. Similar limits were placed on the admissions of Jews to various universities in Eastern Europe between the two world wars and in the Soviet Union after World War II for similar reasons. Education was likewise not the basis for the initial rise of Lebanese immigrants in many societies. Although they came from a country with a tradition of education, 29% of the Lebanese immigrants who arrived in Brazil between 1908 and 1936 were illiterate, as were a majority of those who arrived in the first wave of Lebanese immigrants to 19th century Australia, while most of those who immigrated to Mexico in the 19th century had not completed elementary school, and those among them who were illiterate often kept letters from home for months until they could find someone to read them to them. In Sierra Leone, the Europeanized Africans in Freetown initially looked down on the Lebanese because they were uneducated and poor. Later, this contempt turned into dislike and even hatred when the Lebanese were successful in business. As with the Jews, the Lebanese first rose in occupations not requiring education, but their tradition of respect for education then manifested itself in their later successful rise into the professions. The same pattern could be seen on the other side of the world, among the Chinese minority in Indonesia. Everywhere they went, the Chinese carried with them their reverence for learning, even though the earliest Chinese immigrants to Indonesia were many of them illiterate. In Burma, as late as 1931, there were more illiterate Chinese males than literate ones. What the overseas Chinese had was not necessarily more education than others, but more of an aspiration for education, which their economic rise through other means would allow them to fulfill. What was said of the Lebanese in the Dominican Republic? Having achieved success in the commercial and industrial sphere, many Lebanese encouraged their sons to enter the professions. Could be said of Lebanese and other countries, and of Jews and overseas Chinese as well. In 19th century Germany and Austria, the Jewish intelligentsia was overwhelmingly from families that had succeeded in business. Jewish students, like students from other middleman minorities, tended to specialize in the more difficult and rewarding fields, such as science, medicine, and law. In a later era, Chinese Americans would specialize disproportionately in engineering and science. Even during the era of anti-Chinese feeling in the United States before World War II, Chinese school children were among the favorites of teachers for their academic performance and their good behavior. At the college level, Asian American students have consistently scored higher than white American students on the mathematics portion of the Scholastic Aptitude Test. However, Asian American success in academia and in later careers is not simply a reflection of higher test scores. A scholarly study found that white students had to have IQs 15 points higher to match either the educational or the economic performances of Asian Americans. When university admissions were based on academic performance in Malaysia, the Chinese minority there supplied an absolute majority of the students in higher education. During the decade of the 1960s, the Chinese students outnumbered students from the Malay majority by 100-1 in the absolute number of degrees received in engineering. In Sri Lanka, children from the Tamil middleman minority outperformed members of the Sinhalese majority on admissions tests and in at least 1 year made an absolute majority of the A's on these tests. Here, too, the middleman minority students were particularly concentrated in science, medicine, and the law. During the days of the Ottoman Empire, students in Armenian schools were found to perform not only better than students in Turkish schools, but even wrote better in the Ottoman Turkish language than their Turkish counterparts. During the era of the Soviet Union, Armenia did not require Russian experts to run its economic and other institutions, as some other Soviet republics did. As of 1960, 92% of the experts in Armenia were Armenians. And Armenia also exported about half of its experts to other Soviet republics. The Lebanese have long been among the more highly educated peoples of the Middle East, though in earlier times this did not mean universal literacy, as witnessed by the many illiterate Lebanese immigrants in the 19th and early 20th century. Moreover, it was Christians in Lebanon who were especially likely to become educated. Partly, this was because of Christian missionaries who established schools there for Lebanese Christians. Many of these educated Lebanese immigrated to other countries to live and work, and others went overseas to seek higher education. Before 1970, 40% of all Lebanese entering the United States did so as students. Lebanese students in Brazil tended to specialize in courses that prepared them for careers in business and industry, and later, law. Yet, even those students who went into law tended at first to become attorneys for their family businesses. Political activity. Various ethnic groups in countries around the world have differed greatly in the degree to which they participated in political activity and in the kind of political activity that they engaged in when they did. The Irish, for example, have heavily engaged in politics and have been highly successful at it. Irish political machines long dominated many American cities, even when Irish voters were a minority within those cities. And people of Irish ancestry have become presidents of the United States and prime ministers in Britain, Canada, and Australia. Middleman minorities have typically not been as involved in politics, nor as successful, and the kinds of politics they have pursued are usually different from the pragmatic, bring-home-the-bacon kinds of politics characteristic of the great Irish political machines. For much of the history of Europe and the Islamic world, there was no place in positions of political authority for Jews, Armenians, or Lebanese, just as there was no place for the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia or for Indians in Fiji or East Africa or South Africa. Their whole orientation was usually in other directions, so that even the emergence of democratic societies did not attract as much participation among these groups as among some other ethnic groups. Even the belated emergence of individual politicians from middleman minority groups did not usually mean the development of ethnic group politics. Rather, these political leaders usually rose to prominence as representatives of the larger society. New York's Senator Jacob Javits and Governor Herbert Lehman were general politicians who were Jewish but not ethnic group leaders. In Australia, where the Jews have never been as much as 1% of the population, Jewish politicians have been mayors of Melbourne, Adelaide, and other communities, as well as serving in legislative and judicial posts, obviously not as a result of the Jewish vote, much less as standard bearers of ethnic group politics. The overseas Chinese minorities in Southeast Asia or in the Western Hemisphere have typically avoided political careers, even where they were allowed to participate. Although there has been a Lebanese prime minister in Jamaica and a Peruvian president of Japanese ancestry, these posts were not achieved as a result of being ethnic politics leaders. Indeed, the virtual impossibility of middleman minority political power in these countries enabled these individuals to be viewed as national figures. The exceptional cases where middleman minorities, as such, have played major political roles have involved countries where such minorities were a major portion of the total population, and their economic rise has generally preceded their political prominence, or even their political involvement on a large scale, rather than being a cause of it. Both in Fiji and in Guyana, people from India became at one time or another equal in number to the indigenous Fijian population, or to the population of African ancestry in the case of Guyana. In the latter country, Indian and black politicians formed a coalition to seek independence from Britain, a coalition which later split into polarized parties, each representing its own ethnic group, leading to internal disorder and political repression. In Fiji, the election of an Indian prime minister sparked a military coup led by indigenous Fijians. In Sri Lanka and Nigeria, both British former colonies like Fiji and Guyana, the emergence of independence and democratic government led to ethnic identity politics and to bloody civil wars. The history of middleman minorities offers little support for those who see political power and ethnic identity politics as requirements for group economic advancement. Middleman minorities have typically advanced much more rapidly than other groups that have pursued political routes, even when those other groups have been successful in such pursuits. Nothing is easier than to name prominent political leaders of economically lagging racial and ethnic groups, but such leaders have usually not been as common among middleman minorities. Nor have the exceptional instances where middleman minorities have become heavily involved in politics led to better results for them. Summary and implications. Similarities in economic and social patterns among middleman minorities do not imply that any of these minorities copied others. That Parsis ever thought of themselves as the Jews of India, or the Chinese as the Jews of Southeast Asia. These patterns go back through centuries in which there was no such worldwide communication as the modern world takes for granted. Many of these groups had for centuries no way of knowing what middleman minorities elsewhere did or how. Yet, if these similarities do not imply emulation, what do they imply? One of the implications of these similarities might be that the occupation of middleman minority itself has inherent requirements that must be met by those who successfully fulfill this role. The small capital needed for beginning in retailing at the bottom, perhaps as a peddler or as the owner of a tiny shop, means that many people can engage in this occupation, guaranteeing much competition and correspondingly low profit rates at the beginning of one's entrepreneurial career. Only those willing to endure such deprivations and to put in long hours of work for the sake of the future are likely to last long enough to begin to move up the economic ladder to the remarkable successes which middleman minorities have eventually achieved in many societies. Moreover, this may not be a process which can be completed, once and for all, for any given middleman minority. In many places and times, younger people have been brought in at the bottom, often in third world countries, opening their own tiny businesses in remote hinterlands where few others have set up shop, whether in Africa or in Southeast Asia. Not everyone has either the temperament or the patience for this kind of life. Various kinds of people are precluded from the outset. Brawling drunkards or live-for-the-moment individuals seldom even consider becoming middlemen, much less have any realistic chance of succeeding in such businesses. Given the long years that can pass between initial poverty and eventual prosperity, people with short time horizons are automatically precluded from this field. The utter dominance of particular minorities as middlemen amid vastly larger populations suggests that there are few members of the surrounding society who have all of the characteristics needed. where differences between the whole lifestyle of the middleman minority and that of the majority population around them are so great. This means economic complementarity that benefits both, and social differences which alienate others and which can be exploited by demagogues to generate hostility and backlashes. The history of middleman minorities has been full of both. Longer time horizons for middleman minorities influence their education and the kinds of careers their later generations pursue, as distinguished especially from the educational experiences of groups with shorter time horizons. Many years must elapse before any kind of education reaches a level where it pays off, and this is, of course, particularly true where postgraduate education is a prerequisite for a professional career. People can become rock stars or professional athletes in a relatively few years, but it takes far longer to become a surgeon or scientist. There are correspondingly sharp differences in which groups become prominent or predominant in these different kinds of occupations. It is not only particular ethnic minorities, such as blacks or the Irish, who have at particular times dominated sports and entertainment in the United States, but also white Southerners. All these groups have succeeded out of all proportion to their numbers in the general population, while all have been conspicuously rare among surgeons and scientists, where the descendants of middleman minorities have been overrepresented. Middleman minorities do not happen to be different. That differentness is central to their success, and it carries over into other fields when they branch out into industry, commerce, and the professions. Middleman minorities must get used to long hours of work, for example. Consumers whose jobs leave them little time to shop, except early in the morning or later in the evening, can shop at stores run by people who work long hours. Consumers with low incomes can afford to buy in places where thin profit margins keep prices within reach, even when that restricts the standard of living of the peddlers or shopkeepers. What all this implies is that middleman minorities must be very different from their customers. This differentness, and the social withdrawal needed to preserve this differentness in their children, then leave the middleman minorities vulnerable to charges of clannishness by political and other demagogues. Moreover, the lack of knowledge of either the business or the social imperatives of middlemen by outsiders leaves the majority population vulnerable to exploitation of their ignorance by politicians and activists who can spin plausible-sounding accusations against middlemen minorities. These accusations can exploit racial, religious, or other differences, but this is not to say that such differences are the fundamental reasons for the hostility. None of this need suggest that middleman minorities have done nothing to irritate the surrounding population or even to provoke their hostility. The many internal divisions within particular middleman minorities suggests that there are behaviors and attitudes that provoke negative reactions from other subgroups of Jews, overseas Chinese, Lebanese, and others. Against that background, it would hardly be surprising if members of the larger society were also irritated, repelled, or made hostile by the behavior patterns or attitudes among middleman minorities. Moreover, there is independent evidence of illegal and other repellent behavior by members of middleman minorities who have been no more free of sins than any other segment of the human race. Illegal and often violent gang activities by overseas Chinese Tongs in Southeast Asia go back for centuries, and such activities have likewise followed Chinese immigrants to the Western Hemisphere. Jewish pimps made early 20th century Buenos Aires one of the world centers of prostitution, recruiting women as far away as Eastern Europe. In the United States, there were many prominent Jewish gangsters during the immigrant era, including an organized group of killers for hire called Murder Incorporated. More widespread, if less violent, activities included corruption of public officials by the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia and by Jews in Eastern Europe, both being places where such corruption was widespread in the general population and often especially necessary for middleman minorities in order to escape discriminatory laws. Yet such habits did not end when middleman minorities settled elsewhere. A Yiddish-language newspaper in the United States complained of the corrupt behavior of Jews from Russia who got themselves in trouble offering bribes to American officials. In earlier centuries, middleman minorities and other merchants around the world included slaves among the merchandise they traded. These slave traders included Venetians, Greeks, and Jews in Europe, the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia, and the Arabs who both captured and sold slaves in Africa. Gujaratis from India often financed the African slave trade, though they did not usually conduct it. In medieval Europe, Jews were major slave traders, often selling Slavs who had been enslaved by German conquerors. Jews were also the principal suppliers of white eunuchs as slaves to the Ottoman Empire in the 15th century. Later, as Italian merchants began displacing Jewish merchants in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Black Sea during medieval times, they also began displacing Jews in the Black Sea slave trade. In ancient times, Jews were both slaves and slave owners, as were many other peoples around the world. By the time of the African slave trade to the United States, Jews played only a very minor role. During the antebellum era, Jews owned fewer slaves than free blacks owned, and fewer even than American Indians owned. Most Jewish immigrants arrived in the United States years after slavery had been abolished, and most arrived without enough money to buy a single slave, even had slavery still existed. The same was true of other groups that became middleman minorities in the United States. In short, during an era when slavery was an accepted and unquestioned institution around the world, neither middleman minorities nor any other group made a distinction between selling human beings and selling merchandise. The two things went together for centuries, whether among Europeans, Arabs, Asians, or Africans. When the Yao, a Central African tribe, were the leading traders of ivory in their region, they were also the leading traders of slaves in that region. Too often, the sources of irritation and hostility generated by the behavior and attitudes of middleman minorities themselves have been passed over in silence, lest one be accused of blaming the victim. Yet explanation is not blame, much less an excuse for mass violence against the innocent, or even for bigotry based on ignorance or arrogance. Hostility to middleman minorities has been widespread for centuries, though many have managed to live peacefully until some dramatic event or some talented demagogue managed to stir the population against them. For example, the plagues that decimated Europe in the Middle Ages were sometimes blamed on Jews, leading to mob violence against them. Where has hostility to middleman minorities been greatest? There may not be any single predictor that covers all cases. Yet in broad terms, it seems clear, painfully clear, that they have been most hated where they have been most essential. This has not always been the same as where they make their greatest economic or other contribution. Jews have made great contributions to the United States in a wide range of fields, but there are many other Americans who have also made great contributions in those same fields. Even if Jews' greatest contributions to the world have been in the United States, there have been other countries, in Eastern Europe, for example, where they were more essential because there were relatively few other people doing what they did. Persecution and violence have driven many middleman minorities from many countries, and some have been explicitly expelled by government authorities. The widespread belief that such groups have made no productive contribution to the economies in which they lived has often been belied by the decline or collapse of those economies after their departure. Yet even after such collapses, popular hostility has seldom abated. 20 years after the expulsion of 50,000 Indians and Pakistanis from Uganda in the 1970s had wreaked havoc on that country's economy, economic desperation led the government to seek their return. But the Uganda-Africa trade movement issued a statement declaring that its members intend to wage an atrocious war everywhere in Uganda on any Asian returnee. More explicitly, they said, "We intend to harm, maim, cause them a lot of suffering, even killing them in the most despicable way ever, if they don't leave our land and country immediately." What was threatened in Uganda has been carried out against middleman minorities in many places and times. For example, the Turkish persecutions and mass slaughters of the Armenians during the First World War included bayoneting the men to death, raping the women, dashing their children against the rocks. When the American ambassador protested to a Turkish official, the reply he received was, "The massacres? What of them? They merely amuse me." On one death march in which thousands perished, Ambassador Morgenthau reported that many of the women had been stripped stark naked by their guards and by brigands in league with them. The poor creatures could hardly walk for shame. They staggered into the city bent double. These calculatingly sadistic tortures and humiliations were a foretaste of what would happen to the Jews in Nazi extermination camps a generation later. Note that merely killing middleman minorities was not considered sufficient. Gratuitous infliction of both physical and psychic pain has marked violence against the Chinese in Southeast Asia, as well as against the Armenians in the Ottoman Empire and the Jews in Europe. This suggests that what their enemies feel is not simply a need to be rid of them, but also a need to rid themselves of feelings of inferiority by subjecting middleman minorities to humiliation and dehumanization. These middlemen, their wealth inexplicable, their superiority intolerable, are basically an ego problem among those who have been so blatantly outperformed. This is also consistent with the history of the countries where middleman minorities have either been accepted or bitterly opposed. It is precisely those times and places where there are few others who can supply the skills of middleman minorities that they are most hated. Whether it is the Koreans in today's American black ghettos, Jews in Eastern Poland in centuries past, Chinese in Southeast Asia, Armenians in regions of the Ottoman Empire where they were the most predominant entrepreneurial group, Lebanese in West Africa, Igbos in Northern Nigeria, Indians in East Africa, or others in other places. Where middleman minorities have been more accepted have been places where others have had similar skills and entrepreneurial occupations, such as the United States, Australia, Britain, and the Scandinavian countries. It has been precisely where middleman minorities have been most needed economically that they have been most hated, while places that have been not nearly as dependent on them have been places where they have found their greatest acceptance. This does not present a very reassuring picture of human reasonableness, but neither does the history of most middleman minorities. Where members of middleman minorities have largely moved beyond their middleman occupations into other businesses and professions, and where they have also been accepted by the larger society, the clannishness of their earlier struggling times has tended to erode away as they became assimilated members of the larger society. This happened more often, for example, among Jews in Anglo-American societies, including Australia, than among those in Eastern Europe. Notable examples in 19th century Western Europe include Benjamin Disraeli, David Ricardo, and Karl Marx. While religious restrictions kept Jews out of the British Parliament during the first half of the 19th century, individuals of known Jewish ancestry were able to enter if they were Christians in religion. Thus, David Ricardo sat in Parliament in 1819, and Benjamin Disraeli entered in 1837, eventually becoming Prime Minister. Although Karl Marx was descended from a long line of rabbis on both sides of his family, he was baptized and raised as a Christian living among other Christians in Germany. He never considered himself a Jew and always spoke of Jews in the third person. Even religious Jews were so acculturated in pre-Hitler Germany that they referred to themselves as Germans of the Mosaic faith. Even after emigrating overseas, they often settled among German immigrants in other countries and participated in German cultural organizations in those countries. But Polish Jews never considered themselves Poles, either in Poland or overseas, and did not settle in Polish immigrant neighborhoods. Much the same story could be told of the overseas Chinese, who continue to live in their own enclaves in countries where they encounter hostility, but, in the United States, no longer live primarily in Chinatowns, which have been left to a minority of later arriving immigrants or others who have not assimilated. It would be good to know what proportion of groups known as middleman minorities actually worked in middleman occupations at a given time, but data are seldom available. Most Jews have been middleman minorities in some times and places, but not in others. Apparently, most Lebanese immigrants to Argentina were in such occupations, but most Armenians in the Ottoman Empire were not. Among the occupations declared by Middle Eastern arrivals in Argentina from 1876 to 1900, the overwhelming majority were merchants, and more than a quarter were specifically peddlers as late as 1910. However, it is known that more Armenians in the Ottoman Empire were peasants than were entrepreneurs or moneylenders. But it was in the latter roles that they were more likely to come to the attention of members of the larger society, either through personal contact in the marketplace or through general notoriety. To a greater or lesser degree, that has been true of other middleman minorities. Moreover, the general attitudes of the surrounding society that were formed during the era when these various groups were prominent as middleman minorities have long outlasted that era and continued on as a majority in later generations of middleman minorities have gone into other businesses and professions. Moreover, the striking success of these later generations in education and in other occupations continues to fuel envy and resentment. The role of middleman minorities in various countries around the world has attracted the attention of many scholars and produced many suggested explanations of their roles and experiences. One of the most often cited studies has been A Theory of Middleman Minorities by Edna Bonacich. A crucial element in her theory is that of sojourning. Middleman minorities have often been sojourners rather than permanent settlers in the societies in which they live. Because they begin as sojourners, according to Professor Bonacich, they have less reason to assimilate to the society around them. While sojourning is not a sufficient condition of the middleman, Professor Bonacich says, it is a necessary one. However, if the economic function performed by middlemen requires social separation from the surrounding society and its culture, then whether they plan to return somewhere else or not is no longer crucial. The sojourning theory encounters serious problems that the economic explanation does not. One of the most prominent of middleman minorities has been American Jews, who, as Professor Bonacich concedes, had no plan to return to Eastern Europe. American Jews, in fact, had far lower rates of return migration than did other contemporary immigrants to the United States, or Mexican immigrants in a later era. Even less could Jews who settled in Australia or South America be likely to have had plans to return to their countries of origin. Edna Bonacich attempts to salvage her sojourner thesis by saying that although American Jews did not see Eastern Europe as a place to which they would return, they retained an unusual attachment to an ancestral homeland in the Middle East. Yet Zionism was by no means common among Jews around the world during the period of mass migration to the United States, and in fact, there was hostility to the idea among Orthodox Jews, as well as among Western European Jews in general. Moreover, emotional attachment to an ancestral homeland says nothing about any plans to return to it today. Irish Americans, like Jewish Americans, have maintained an emotional attachment to their ancestral homeland. But nevertheless, there are more people of Irish ancestry living in the United States than in Ireland, just as there are more Jews living in the United States than in Israel. By the time Zionism was rekindled after the Second World War by the establishment of Israel, American Jews were culturally assimilated and had rising rates of intermarriage with the general population, as well as moving out of middleman occupations and into the professions. In short, sojourning seems neither necessary nor sufficient, nor even plausible, to explain the cultural separation of Jews or other middleman minorities. While it is true that many middleman minorities began their careers abroad as sojourners, the Chinese in Southeast Asia or the Lebanese in West Africa, for example, so did other immigrant groups such as the Italians, an absolute majority of whom returned to Italy, not only from other European countries, but also from the United States and even South America. That remains true today of immigrants from India and Pakistan working in the Middle East. As Professor Bonacich concedes, the fact that many middleman minorities began as sojourners does not mean that most of them, in fact, returned home. There were growing permanent settlements of Chinese in Southeast Asia, for example, even as the Chinese continued to live wholly separate social lives from those of the surrounding Malay or Indonesian societies. Sojourning has been a phase in the immigration of many groups who never became middleman minorities, with their settlements abroad becoming permanent only after achieving a satisfactory modus vivendi with the surrounding population. Another feature of middleman minorities cited by various scholars has been their tendency to invest in highly mobile capital, intellectual skills being the ultimate in portability, rather than in fixtures that could not move, such as the machinery of heavy industry, land, dams, or transmission lines for electricity or conduits for water. No doubt centuries of a history of being victims of spoliation and confiscation, as well as being forced by mob violence or official expulsion to flee and leave much of their wealth behind, has made highly portable wealth particularly attractive to middleman minorities. Cash, gems, and intellectual skills are among these highly portable forms of wealth. Moreover, even forms of wealth that are not strictly portable, but which can be readily liquidated, such as inventories of groceries, textiles, clothing, or sewing machines, have been preferable to steel mills, railroads, or hydroelectric dams. None of this depends upon an orientation toward a homeland, as Professor Banacich contends. Indians and Pakistanis fleeing Uganda fled to Britain more often than to India or Pakistan, and in an earlier era, Jews fleeing persecution in Eastern Europe fled to the United States far more often than to the Middle East. While our focus has been on patterns among middleman minorities in general, what of the Jews specifically? To what extent are they generic, and to what extent do they have their own separate and distinct patterns? Jews are, like every other individual and group, unique in some ways, and very much like other people in other ways. Whatever has been unique, or thought to be unique, about them has been seized upon and used negatively by their enemies. Their supposed role in the crucifixion of Jesus, Christ killers, in the bitter indictment of a bygone era of religious bigotry, can hardly have been the reason for that bigotry, for it was the Romans who actually crucified Jesus, and no such guilt has been attached to the whole Italian people of later centuries. Moreover, wholly fictitious complaints have been invoked against the Jews, that they were responsible for medieval plagues, for example, when whoever made up these charges obviously had other reasons for hostility. It is these other reasons that have been common to numerous other groups who have faced similar hostility in countries around the world, despite differing from the Jews in religion, language, and other social and cultural traits. Some have regarded the Holocaust as making anti-Jewish feeling unique, at least in intensity. Yet what made the Holocaust possible were technological and organizational capabilities for mass murder that enemies of other middleman minorities simply did not have available. In view of what was actually done to some of these other groups, there is little reason to doubt that their persecutors would have used such technological and organizational capabilities if they had had them. In Eric Hoffer's account of a mass movement's need for unifying elements, he classified hatred as one of those elements. He quoted Hitler as saying that if there was no such thing as a Jew, we should then have to invent him. It is essential to have a tangible enemy, not merely an abstract one. Hoffer added, F.A. Voigt tells of a Japanese mission that arrived in Berlin in 1932 to study the National Socialist Movement. Voigt asked a member of the mission what he thought of the movement. He replied, "It is magnificent. I wish we could have something like it in Japan, only we can't, because we haven't got any Jews." The tragic history of middleman minorities around the world shows that often there are many substitutes for Jews in the role of scapegoats, as well as in their economic functions. In terms of their achievements in the arts and sciences, Jews have been unique, not only among middleman minorities, but also among the world's population at large. They have been particularly overrepresented among the leading figures in such fields as mathematics, the sciences, and philosophy. In the second half of the 20th century, Jews won 29% of all the Nobel Prizes in the sciences, medicine, and literature combined, even though Jews were less than one-half of 1% of the world's population. Such spectacular achievements have come only in relatively recent times, as history is measured. These have been largely the achievements of Ashkenazic Jews, who were excluded from civil society for many centuries in most of Europe where they lived. And their remarkable rise to prominence among the leading intellectual figures dates largely from the 19th century, when severe restrictions on them were relaxed in a growing number of European countries. It was in the new nation of the United States that Jews were first accorded civil equality, and it was here that their greatest successes were achieved. Another way of looking at this is that much of the world, for much of history, lost the benefits of the talents of these people, and of similar people elsewhere, through suppression and persecution. While the intellectual achievements of Jews have been unique, the bigotry and persecution that they suffered has been the fate of middleman minorities around the world. While there are characteristics and achievements which are uniquely Jewish, the history of middleman minorities around the world seems to suggest that it has not been these uniquely Jewish characteristics which called forth venomous hatreds, but characteristics and achievements common to middleman minorities, both when they are in that occupational role and after they move beyond it into a wide range of occupations. Whatever is unique to each of these groups may be seized upon by those promoting hatred of them, but that does not mean that the promotion of hatred in the first place has been due to qualities unique to each group. However unique any of these groups may be, historically, the kind of hostility and hatred they have faced has been generic. The Real History of Slavery. Slavery was an evil of greater scope and magnitude than most people imagine, and, as a result, its place in history is radically different from the way it is usually portrayed. Mention slavery, and immediately the image that arises is that of Africans and their descendants enslaved by Europeans and their descendants in the southern United States, or at most, Africans enslaved by Europeans in the Western Hemisphere. No other historic horror is so narrowly construed. No one thinks of war, famine, or decimating epidemics in such localized terms. These are afflictions that have been suffered by the entire human race all over the planet, and so was slavery. Had slavery been limited to one race in one country during 3 centuries, its tragedies would not have been 1/10 the magnitude that they were in fact. Why this provincial view of a worldwide evil? Often, it is those who are most critical of a Eurocentric view of the world who are most Eurocentric when it comes to the evils and failings of the human race. Why would anyone wish to arbitrarily understate an evil that plagued mankind for thousands of years, unless it was not this evil itself that was the real concern, but rather the present-day uses of that historic evil? Clearly, the ability to score ideological points against American society or Western civilization, or to induce guilt and thereby extract benefits from the white population today, are greatly enhanced by making enslavement appear to be a peculiarly American or a peculiarly white crime. This explanation is also consistent with the otherwise inexplicable contrast between the fiery rhetoric about past slavery in the United States used by those who pass over in utter silence the traumas of slavery that still exist in Mauritania, the Sudan, and parts of Nigeria and Benin. Why so much more concern for dead people who are now beyond our help than for living human beings suffering the burdens and humiliations of slavery today? Why does a verbal picture of the abuses of slaves in centuries past arouse far more response than contemporary photographs of present-day slaves in Time magazine, the New York Times, or the National Geographic? It takes no more research than a trip to almost any public library or college library to show the incredibly lopsided coverage of slavery in the United States or in the Western Hemisphere as compared to the meager writings on the even larger number of Africans enslaved in the Islamic countries of the Middle East and North Africa, not to mention the vast numbers of Europeans also enslaved in centuries past in the Islamic world and within Europe itself. At least 1 million Europeans were enslaved by North African pirates alone from 1500 to 1800. And some European slaves were still being sold on the auction block in Egypt, years after the Emancipation Proclamation freed blacks in the United States. Indeed, an Anglo-Egyptian treaty of August 4, 1877, prohibited the continued sale of white slaves after August 3, 1885, as well as prohibiting the import and export of Sudanese and Abyssinian slaves. During the Middle Ages, Slavs were so widely used as slaves in both Europe and the Islamic world that the very word slave derived from the word for Slav, not only in English, but also in other European languages, as well as in Arabic. Nor have Asians or Polynesians been exempt from either being enslaved or enslaving others. China, in centuries past, has been described as one of the largest and most comprehensive markets for the exchange of human beings in the world. Slavery was also common in India, where it has been estimated that there were more slaves than in the entire Western Hemisphere, and where the original thugs kidnapped children for the purpose of enslavement. In some of the cities of Southeast Asia, slaves were a majority of the population. Slavery was also an established institution in the Western Hemisphere, before Columbus's ships ever appeared on the horizon. The Ottoman Empire regularly enslaved a percentage of the young boys from the Balkans, converted them to Islam, and assigned them to various duties in the civil or military establishment. Race and slavery. The instrumental use of the history of slavery today, also underlies the claim that slavery grew out of racism. For most of its long history, which includes most of the history of the human race, slavery was largely not the enslavement of racially different people, for the simple reason that only in recent centuries has either the technology or the wealth existed to go to another continent to get slaves and transport them en masse across an ocean. People were enslaved because they were vulnerable, not because of how they looked. The peoples of the Balkans were enslaved by fellow Europeans, as well as by the peoples of the Middle East, for at least 6 centuries before the first African was brought to the Western Hemisphere. Before the modern era, by and large, Europeans enslaved other Europeans, Asians enslaved other Asians, Africans enslaved other Africans, and the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere enslaved other indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere. Slavery was not based on race, much less on theories about race. Only relatively late in history did enslavement across racial lines occur on such a scale as to promote an ideology of racism that outlasted the institution of slavery itself. Wherever a separate people were enslaved, they were disdained or despised, whether they were different by country, religion, caste, race, or tribe. The Europeans who were enslaved in North Africa were despised and abused because they were Christians in a Muslim region of the world, where they were called Christian dogs. Race became the most visible difference between slaves and slave owners in the Western Hemisphere. As distinguished historian Daniel J. Boorstin put it, "Now, for the first time in Western history, the status of slave coincided with a difference of race." To make racism the driving force behind slavery is to make a historically recent factor the cause of an institution which originated thousands of years earlier. This enshrinement of racism as an overarching causal factor accords far more with current instrumental agendas than with history. The form in which the story of slavery has reached most people today has been along the lines of the best-selling book and widely watched television miniseries Roots by Alex Haley. Challenged on the historical accuracy of Roots, Haley said, "I tried to give my people a myth to live by." This instrumental use of history, or purported history, is open to the same objections as other instrumental myth-making. First is the objection to falsification itself, that the damage which this does to the general level of understanding and trust in a society is incalculable, and can easily outweigh, in its long-run consequences especially, any immediate good that might be expected from an expedient taking of liberties with the truth. Second, even the short-run benefits are by no means clear. Has a sense of special grievance helped advance any people? Or has what happened in centuries past been a distraction and an incitement to counterproductive strife, much as territorial irredentism has been? Rather than debate current ideological agendas, we can try to determine what we can about the actual history of slavery, including how it ended. No institution of comparable age and worldwide scope has ever disappeared, over almost the entire planet, leaving so little awareness of how and why it vanished or so little interest in that question. Volumes continue to be published about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, which, for all its greatness, did not encompass 1/10 as much of the world as the institution of slavery did. Archaeologists continue to excavate the ruins of ancient civilizations in Central America and the Middle East, while military historians pore through archives and examine ancient weapons to try to piece together the history of warfare. Yet remarkably little is written about one of the most momentous moral dramas in the history of the human species, the bitter worldwide struggle which lasted for more than a century to destroy the elaborate systems and institutions for the ownership and sale of human beings. While there is a sizable literature on the American Civil War, for all its staggering carnage and historic legacy within the United States, in an international perspective, it is only a small and highly atypical part of the story of the worldwide crusade against slavery. No other nation ended slavery in the same way as the United States did, and few ended it after so short a struggle, as history is measured. How and why did slavery end in most of the world? There were two major processes. Over the centuries, as more and more territories around the world consolidated into nation-states with their own armies and navies, raiding those territories to capture and enslave the people who lived within them became more hazardous in itself, and also risked military retaliation against the countries from which the raiders came. Thus, more and more peoples became off-limits to slave raiders over time. Put differently, the areas which remained subject to slave raiding over the centuries were primarily those where the people lived in smaller or weaker societies. Such societies continued to exist where it was difficult, for geographic or other reasons, to consolidate large areas under one government. This was true of the Balkans, the backwaters of Asia, and much of sub-Saharan Africa. By the early modern era, sub-Saharan Africa, with its numerous and severe geographic handicaps, was one of the last remaining areas from which vast numbers of people could be enslaved. Far from being targeted by Europeans for racial reasons, as some have claimed, Africa was resorted to as a source of large supplies of slaves only after centuries of Europeans enslaving other Europeans had been brought to an end by the consolidation of nations and empires on the European continent, by internal shifts from slavery to serfdom in much of Europe, and by the Catholic Church's pressures against enslaving fellow Christians, which was by no means the same as the Church's saying that slavery, as such, was wrong. Similar consolidations of political units in parts of Asia led to a decline of slavery in those realms. While Africa became the main source of new slaves in later centuries, existing slaves continued to include peoples of many races living in many places around the world. Ending the slavery of all these peoples was a very difficult process, and one requiring deliberate and sustained action for many generations. Ironically, the anti-slavery ideology behind this process began to develop in 18th century Britain, at a time when the British Empire led the world in slave trading, and when the economy of most of its overseas colonies in the Western Hemisphere depended on slaves. Here again, the baffling present-day disregard of an international saga of strife, full of individual dramas as well as historic consequences, seems explicable only in terms of today's ideological agendas. While slavery was common to all civilizations, as well as to peoples considered uncivilized, only one civilization developed a moral revulsion against it very late in its history –